Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
And Alex, we have a very special guest with us today. Do you know who it is?
Santa Claus.
Well, it's kind of like Santa Claus, I suppose. No, we have, for Maze Arcana, Rudy Rutenberg. Rudy, thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
A little bird told me, and you can clarify this if I am wrong, that you are sort of the mechanics wizard of Maze Arcana. Is that correct?
Sure. We'll say that I am the resident mechanic of MZA.
That feels like a huge undertaking from my perspective. Am I right on that?
Well, I suppose. I mean, I don't know what your intro into mechanics would be or what your desire to do mechanics is. So perhaps it is a very big undertaking. It's kind of like one of those things where a lot of people who favor roleplay think that mechanics is actually something that gets in the way of it, whereas that may not actually be the case if they weren't worried about the mechanics as much.
Mm-hmm. Nathan is a, what should we call you? A D&D beginner?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So do you find mechanics intimidating?
All the time, but in like my life and everywhere else too. So it's not limited to D&D.
The unknowing, I think, is what sets that as a, not a fear per se, but sets that as your tone, like where you're entering it as. I can understand that. I think everybody has that at first when they approach something new.
Right. I tried to learn 3.5 at one point, and I think the stat sheets just got me a little bit overwhelmed out of the gate. And I know 5 is different, but I just haven't built up enough confidence, I guess, to really delve into it more. So,
I see what you did there. The Well, here's the great thing about 5, is that it is the most elegant system I think that D&D has come around to, and that means that it incorporates enough of the crunchy bits to keep people that came in around 3 and 3.5 happy. But it's also enough of a callback to second edition, which was very simplistic and very focused on, oh, you want to do this kind of a thing? Well, that's this. But they've left it open to having interpretation now, where if you want to do a thing, let's say, let's just call it like acrobatics, right? Is sure. The idea. You want to scramble to the top of a roof.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a couple ways to go about deciding what the best path is up to that roof. And while most people might just say, and this is not wrong by any means, but this is one way to handle it. While most people might say, oh, well, you want to see what the fastest way up to that thing is? Okay, give me a perception check. All right, good. So by your perception, you can tell that this ledge and that ledge will get you up there relatively safely. And now that you've plotted out your course, you can have advantage on your acrobatics check.
Oh.
But what if you weren't proficient in perception? And you are proficient in acrobatics,
okay.
There's a greater chance of your success in knowing where those steps are if you were to combine, say, your acrobatics with wisdom, right? Because you get your acrobatics proficiency bonus on top of your wisdom bonus, which you would not have gotten if you went with perception. So it creates a thing where a DM has a greater repertoire of which to pull by saying, well, as being versed in acrobatics, being proficient with that, you may not necessarily be the most perceptive person in the world, but you do have enough experience to see which ledges are going to get you there because you've done this enough times. So there's ways that you can go about it that make, I would say, the difference between an experienced GM and a new GM, or even just one that's been a GM for a long time but is getting their footing and doesn't think necessarily as much about the theory behind mechanics and how it affects role play. But there is the way to tell kind of those things is one who can figure out where the bending can happen and where to justify it so that it isn't a blanket statement, it balances for the group, as opposed to sometimes things will feel a little bit unfair if they are not just kept cut and dry in the most elegant, flat terms of what fifth edition is. Like, no, you want to see what this is? That's going to be a wisdom check. That's perception. You know?
Oh, okay.
A lot of that can come down to GM preference and player preference as well.
Right.
Which is really fun because, as you said, bending the rules a little bit, some people are really sticklers for, no, it's the rule this way. It has to exactly be that. But I find it more fun when you can go, I'm going to bend this rule a little bit here because it's in the spirit of more fun for the players, and it makes sense in certain places as well.
Right. The one thing that I like to remind people who either fancy themselves as rule lawyers or who might fall into that category is that you can rule lawyer all you want to, but there's still a judge, and that's another term for a DM. And so when the judge makes the decision, you're overruled, or they take whatever it is into consideration. And if you continue to argue, they'll hold you in contempt. And that's what I'll do. So the idea is to make something that it is, like you said, in the best spirit of the game and helps to build the story around the group. And somebody who is intent on winning all the time, which is typically where we see the cross section, I think, of rule lawyering happen, they're not necessarily looking at it in the spirit of the game or in the success of the group, because sometimes success is failure. We get our best character moments out of those failures. And you actually can't win if you don't fail first.
This is true in things that aren't even RPGs.
Yeah, it's a pretty good life lesson.
It is a very good life lesson that you should take to your D&D games or any other RPG play and go with it.
Exactly. So yeah. I heard from a little bird that you guys had a bunch of questions that kind of surround mechanics and whatnot as well.
Yeah, we kind of did, didn't we, Alex? You're the mechanics guy.
I love mechanics. I like game design. I like mechanics. So hearing that you also like those things makes me really happy. So as you said with the rules lawyers, what do you think about, how do you mitigate them from having an iron fist on the game?
Pretty much like I just said.
Right, fair enough. Right. Yeah.
I think that the thing is that you need to remember that a rules lawyer is, you got to remember the intentions of things. And a rule lawyer is trying to keep the game even. They're also trying to make sure that the things that they want to exploit, and I do mean that in a legal sense, not in a malicious sense, but the things that they're trying to exploit are things that they've spent quite a bit of time out of game considering and thinking about. And they may even be doing it to help other players. But what often escapes you when you get so heated in that moment is that your dungeon master has a plan. And whatever the plan that you made is, or even that your group made in the moment, is still going to be superseded by that plan. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting railroaded. It just means that you can't possibly know how your interaction with the old man on the side of the road is going to come back around later.
I feel like that's why a lot of people just murder hobo the old man on the side of the road.
It's possible. I don't typically allow murder hoboing in general. That comes with really swift consequences in my world. I also come to the table always with a session zero, even if it's an Adventures League game. I always take a little bit of time before that to make sure that there is a moment where it's like, hey, this is how I run. This is the things that you can expect out of what's going on here. And my catchphrase for my tables is a world with no consequence is of no consequence. And thus a story with no consequence is of no consequence. So when you're doing these things, that's not meant to give you some amount of paralyzation, choice paralyzation or whatever, but it's meant to have you consider what you're going to do, because there is no right answer. The only right answer is that you give me an answer and you take the journey with me to see what the fruition is, because I may not necessarily know in the moment what that thing is going to be, but I know that if you belabor the point and make me dwell on it, I'm not going to think of great things for you.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay. So now wait a second. Okay. Now, as the newbie, I have a question. So you're telling me if I go and just hack and slash at everything I see, there might be consequences to my actions?
Not mine.
Well,
there will always be consequences. You can't swing a sword without it having a pull and tug on your arm when you need to stop it. Either that or you're letting go of it and it's swinging across the room. There's always consequences to what you do. It's just a matter of how they are enforced, right? So,
right.
And this kind of goes into the theory behind the mechanics in a way, because the whole thing about mechanics is simply just putting the cogs together. Doesn't mean that you necessarily put them together to where they work soundly, even if the cogs turn. What you need to be aware of is balance. And that's the final, that's like the test for whether a mechanic should be used. Where do we get that? Is we get that from the fact that your group should feel a balance in the storytelling. If you're playing and you've got, you know, you're our new guy, and we've got Nate. So it's Nate and Alex. So Nate's the new guy. Alex is the old hat. Mm-hmm. You guys should be able to go through the story and not be like, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. Why did he get to do this and I didn't? I used the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, in the context of the situation and with the role of this, that's why this outcome would happen. You don't stop the game to do that, hopefully. But these are things that you can cover in a post-game or an ex-pre-game thing and just be like, hey, so I didn't understand why this thing happened. Can you tell me behind the answer behind that? And if a dungeon master's like doesn't have an appropriate reason behind it or is going all willy-nilly, then you're going to feel perhaps like somebody's playing favorites or that they don't have a handle on what's going on. And perhaps you'll feel like you're being railroaded. The greatest thing a DM can do is have a story that you are railroaded along and you don't know.
The illusion of choice is fantastic.
Right. And sometimes I err on the side of actually giving too much choice to a lot of my players because I do want to see what they're going to do and I don't want them to feel like they're being railroaded ever. That's kind of like one of the ways that balance helps you to maintain the grasp that you have over a captive audience. You want them to be captivated, not captives.
Right, right. I can understand.
Sometimes.
Well, yeah.
Nathan gets captured a lot.
I do, quite often. Now, Rudy, I actually had a question kind of on that note. I had a short stint where I was the GM for a thing, and one thing I wanted my players to experience was a campaign where they didn't feel like in order to advance in the storyline all the time, they had to just go around and, you know, pick fights or just engage in that way, that there were always other options. How do you really explain to the players that there are those options? How do you encourage those other options besides just, you know, swinging a sword?
Well, there are plenty of ways to present opportunities to players. You could, in the middle of a fight, you know, if an orc grapples somebody or something and pulls them away from their friends, there's an opportunity for that orc to call for parley. There is an opportunity for you to put NPCs that are sided with the party in a situation where they're able to start the conversation, but the PCs need to finish it. And that means hopefully in a non-violent fashion. But showing the PCs that, and this is one of the things that I don't like about alignment, but showing the PCs that there are other ways to approach a situation and other resolutions is pretty much all you need to do. And by showing, I mean like actually presenting the option in a way that is very similar, at least in the early goings of your campaign, very similar to kind of, you know, hitting them over the head with the option to do that. One of the things that we're doing right now with Inkwell is we're making sure that the players understand just how frail they are in this world by starting them at level zero, by giving them four hit points plus their modifier and saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. You could actually, if you go up against somebody who is proficient with their hands, like really proficient with their hands, it could kill you outright. You could suffer a concussion or internal bleeding or something and you're dead. So understand that when death is a real consequence and whatever you're working towards can be erased with one bad decision, Mm-hmm. Do you want to maybe take other opportunities to solve a problem that don't involve that thing that could kill you immediately? A lot of the times you sit down in a situation where PCs have done hack and slash, hack and slash, hack and slash, and then they get to a diplomatic encounter with a nobility. And then they talk to nobility as if that nobility is any old douchebag from the streets. And that's not usually the way that nobility would want to be talked to, and probably not the way that you want them to show irreverence to the NPCs in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you allow them to wield their power drunkly, then they will act belligerently in other situations.
Mm-hmm. That is pretty accurate for a lot of things. So you mentioned that your party starts at level zero. They have 4 hit points plus their con modifier, maybe some armor, I assume.
No
armor, even better.
Well, you got, so here's this goes into mechanics, right? Because how did I decide what that was going to be? We don't have any current rules for level zero, do we?
We do not.
But the one thing that everybody gets prior to picking up a class is a background. It stands to reason that a background you would have before you have a class. Beyond that, that gives you a couple of proficiencies. So whatever that background granted is what they have. We also don't have a class that uses a D4 for health. So it stands to reason that a D4 plus their constitution modifier gets them their baseline of hit points. Now, I do know that that gives you a scenario where the standard commoner is actually tougher than any of them, but they do have better stats than a standard commoner, which is 10 across the board.
So they're essentially on par with a 3.5 wizard that has no spells.
Essentially, they are failures waiting to grasp at greatness.
So on that note, where you have so little hit points and you want them to feel the mortality, you want them to feel vulnerable and like they actually can die. And I do notice in a lot of D&D games, people be like, oh, we've got a cleric, so we can just have them heal us every time we take injuries. How do you feel mechanically that helps with storytelling or maybe hinders storytelling sometimes as well? Because having that, like, the MMO mentality of having just this person dedicated to healing, in my opinion, it makes it so the players don't feel the mortality as much.
Fifth edition is a very forgiving system. You could actually go through an entire game without having a class that can heal. They're going to get to heal at some point when they take a short rest or a long rest or drink potions or whatever. In my game right now, making that morality... making the mortality feel consistent happens in the fact that there is no cleric in their party. They have no class. So beyond that, the setting, Eberron, doesn't really have a whole bunch of healers that are just willing to take care of somebody for no reason. House Jurasco, which is the mark of healing that the halflings have, they do it for profit. That's how their house makes money. So they're not just going to be like all willy-nilly with that. Beyond that, the highest levels in Eberron cap out somewhere around 13 for NPCs, and much lower usually. That 13th level cleric, actually, that's the closest person to divinity that they have. And if they leave a very specific area, they drop down to like a third level cleric. So there's not a whole lot of that that's available. And as they earn it, they should feel like, oh, we can be more risky. We can go in and do these things. We can approach the game from with this as a new option. But starting them without the option to do it kind of puts them in the mindset where they know that the world is a deadly world and they should fear it. Also, when I tend to kill somebody, I don't let them reroll.
They're just dead.
Yeah, and if you watch some of the Maze Arcana content, when we've had players die, they're gone. They're off the show. So it gives them a little bit more of a feeling of earnestness in that we have consequences to the actions, and they sometimes will justify, oh, well, my character would do this X or Y. without it necessarily being something that's in the best interest of the group or story. And I think that if you want to be a good player, you should remember that in a story, sometimes characters don't act in exactly the form that their characters would. They act in a way that serves the story, meaning that if there's something that they don't think that they would do, they will figure out what it is that they need emotionally or logically or whatever to justify making that choice, and then use that as character growth and say, well, this is how, you know, like I used to be this person. I didn't do these things. And then there was a moment where I had to. And this, it was more important to me to save Nathan than it was to adhere to my no killing monkish tradition. But now we don't tell anybody that I was actually the one that did that. So now we've got a secret between Nathan and I that creates a bigger story arc down the line. And that gives the DM something to play with. Be like, oh, I heard the guy died from a punch. No, it was, it, no, it's not true. It didn't happen. It was a hammer. It was a hammer with that was shaped like a fist. Well, where's this hammer? Shoot, we got to go get a quest to build a hammer like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I have to go to the blacksmith. I got to go to the blacksmith, find a hammer, get the hammer so I can prove that it was a hammer. Oh, man. Yeah.
And I can prove that it was somebody else that did the killing besides me.
Absolutely. I like the idea that I have to think of real moral choices that are going to affect my character because permadeath is real.
I've definitely run into that encounter before where your choices are aligned with what your character would do and end up in a deadly situation. I had a character that oversaw, I think it was a Barogura. That word is always terrible to say.
Barjera?
A demon. A demon ape looking thing. And my character was alone and saw it slaughtering people, and it was like, oh, do I know what this is? You do know what this is. It's an ancient enemy from your home on the islands. And I went, oh, well, my character's a hunter and a druid, and he hates demons and aberrations. I go, he's gonna try to kill it, knowing full well out of character that I would probably die. Fun fact, I died in one round of combat.
Yeah. Well,
but it served the story. It actually, the other character in the party, because it's just the two of us, found my corpse because it was strung up in the city walls and brought me to get resurrected. Very emotional, very emotional. But it served the story really well. So I died. I did come back to life because he found someone who could do it. But it served the story. And yes, we definitely feel mortal.
Right. And that's a good way, like, as long as that stuff is communicated in advance from your dungeon master, and even if that's just in advance of that specific session, then all of those things keep people from feeling as if they're being taken advantage of or that they're not having fun. Because let's face it, a lot of PCs are going to get pretty upset when they die. That's where we hear a lot of the table flipping kind of scenario.
The funny part for this one actually was we were separate from the party and we play online, so it was just me and the DM, and the other player had no idea what's going on at this point in time. So when the other player found out of and in character, he was just like, what, he died? Oh my god.
That's fantastic.
I was keeping the secret for him for like 3 months until we resumed playing. I was just sitting on this going, can't tell him, can't tell him, can't tell him. And then he found out and it was like, oh my god, what do you mean you're dead?
Yeah, that's really fantastic. And then you get, you know, like there's also something to say, well, like, what do you think most people would have done in that situation? Do you think they would have been, they would have leaned more towards ignoring the demon or running or whatever? Because I can see character justification in, I know that thing would smash me and living to fight another day would actually help me to stop it. Or did you serve some purpose? Did your death serve a purpose besides immortality?
It served his character because of how I've made him, where he's a druid. He's a lycanthrope on top of being a shapeshifter in general. but a hunter, and he's got a really intense sense of, like, not justice for, like, law, but justice for things that are natural, and just to him, a very, very much a self sense of honor, almost, on what's right and what's wrong. And seeing this thing slaughter innocent people, even though he doesn't like, you know, cities and doesn't really care for humans a whole lot because he's an outsider, it was just the, all right, this thing's an ancient enemy. I know what this is. This is evil, and it's got to be stopped, whether I die or not. So to my character, it served the purpose of this is what he would do because this is right to him. Whereas I definitely see other parties or players would have been like, nope, turn tail.
Yeah, and I think the interesting dynamic of is the way that you guys were playing that game, because it what you did, if you had an actual group or party around, they would have felt compelled to assist you or something like that. So your choice in this situation didn't actually put anybody else at a disadvantage. In fact, it created story situations for the other person who was absent at the time.
Oh yeah.
That's all fantastic stuff.
I thought it was great. We actually ended up, he had to bring me somewhere way away to get resurrected, and the city ended up under siege because we had basically just raised an army to revolt against the other player's half brother, who's the regent lord tyrant. So while we were away, a siege on the city started, and we weren't there to assist until much later. Oops. It was going to happen, but we were supposed to be there.
It's good. I favor a persistent world as well.
Oh, it's wonderful when you have a world that does things when the players aren't interacting with it as well, I think. You say persistent world, I call it a dynamic world myself. Whereas the world exists outside of the player actions as well.
Yep.
Because a lot of things you'll see, the world will just interact with the players. And not all games, not every DM. But in a lot, I'll see that, especially with newbie GMs as well, because, oh, well, the players have to be the center of it. How do you feel about the players not always being the center of the world itself? Like, yes, their story is important, but there are other stories going on that you don't see. It like the off-screen stuff on a film.
Yeah, you pretty much said it. And I think that also is something that lends to them feeling more of mortality than having the idea that not only is it their movie, like, but there are no Avengers. It's just them. They are the end of it. Whereas in reality, yeah, this world existed before them and probably after them. And it's important for them to handle themselves in a way that keeps that in mind instead of the idea that, well, once we're done with it, this world's over, we don't care.
Right. I feel like we've talked a little bit about it, but you had mentioned something about the idea of mechanics creating a safe space for role play. We've had a couple conversations on this show with some people that made me occasionally think that mechanics and storytelling are opposing forces, but that's not necessarily true, right?
And not only do I think that is not necessarily true, I think that is a myth that is created in order to either justify or facilitate not learning. What I mean by that is that there are all rules are the boundaries of communication, and our entire game, all RPG experiences about role playing, which is just the communication that you have between different entities, be that characters or people or whatever. And so what rules give you is a clearly defined box for what is okay and what is not. And when you homebrew a rule or you modify a part of it, you're just saying, okay, this is a different angle that we're going to use for this line. Like, the more that you know about the rules, the more you can bend them. But if you don't know the rules, you're sort of fumbling around in the dark. And when you run into a wall and it hurts, like it hits your nose, breaks it, whatever, it knocks you out of the immersion. You're like, well, that's stupid. I don't like that rule. I don't want to play this. Because it interrupted and it kind of hurts your pride. If you knew the rules in advance, you don't have to worry about that. You're just, oh, I know this is where this line is. And if I need to bend it, I can ask. I can communicate that to everybody in advance. I know that this isn't how the rule works, but could I do something like this? And your GM can go, yes, give me a this role, a that role, and a this role, and this is how we're going to play that. But yeah. If you don't know those rules, then you might as well be the kids running around the yard, swinging imaginary swords at each other, going, I hit you, nah.
No backsies. Yeah, I would definitely be the person who hit a wall and of my own making. So I just have to be on point so that I know where my boundaries are.
Beyond that, and this is like the whole point of RPGs and stuff like that, right? In role playing in general, like, yes, we get to have fun with it, but it also helps us learn how we would react to situations. It makes us consider reacting to situations. That gives us a boundary for how we would react to it in real life. And the way that we react to it in game, or even consider how a character would react to it in game, gives us insight into that moment and all the things that are there. And really what the majority of our decisions come down to are fear and love. And mm-hmm. that even comes down to learning mechanics, right? Learning how to play a game. Well,
sure.
Again, your pride is mostly based on your fear and about maintaining that illusion of knowing what you're doing when in fact you probably don't. Right. And there's nothing wrong with that. But people feel like there's something wrong with it. And they would rather just say, well, I don't like this rule, or I don't like this game, than to admit that, oh, I didn't actually know that thing. And so when you put yourself in an open space to say, I actually don't know this thing, and I wish I did, can you explain it to me? Or how can we continue playing the game? Like, how would you like to run that rule? Then you're actually, that's actually out of love. You're giving that to somebody and giving them the option, or letting them know that you feel safe enough with them to admit that you are vulnerable.
I see. Yeah, that's so interesting, because I see so many people, especially ones that we interact with online, where it feels like the whole nature of tabletop gaming and their involvement in it has actually been very beneficial to them in real life and their interactions in society.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Good. I guess that's another reason why I should be more involved with it, right?
Well, we do, you know, for instance, we do a lot that has to do with how role-playing games work out PTSD. I was in the military for a while. I went and served overseas. Satine, my partner for Maze Arcana and business partner, she has had some traumatic experiences in her past. And the role playing is part of what helps you be okay with the world and justify your existence, that you are worthwhile to people. You are worthwhile to be around. And there's not a reason why you shouldn't continue to be a blessing on other people's lives and to seek that out. And that's what role playing kind of shows you, is that even broken people, which is what, you know, we essentially all are still valuable people, and you're still valuable to your group, the party, the world, except your best friend, etc. You don't have to live in a state where you feel like you're worthless or like life is better without you.
Right. Absolutely.
I think that's a wonderful point. And it helps also when the RPG and the tabletop community, as a majority, is a fairly inclusive place to be. Where you can play whatever character you want. You can be the person you want to be, or be someone you don't want to be, or someone you just want to try and be. And I think it's wonderful that, as a whole, the community is fairly inclusive and helpful to each other. And it's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, I put a lot of effort into, I think nowadays, especially like the generations that are sitting there, you know, in the 30s and down, are... like, to us, I don't think race matters as much as it has in the past. I think that our connectivity to the internet has put us in a place where we're not afraid of, we don't have the reason to differentiate ourselves in those ways, which is, again, a thing of fear. Like, that's a motive of fear. There's a reason, and we learned a lot about the psychology of this in the military, is that it's dehumanization. And we don't care as much about that sort of a thing. So for us, it is actually probably more important to play something adverse to who you individually are, so that you can experience the mindset of somebody else.
Now, if that ending seemed a little bit abrupt, I swear I did not do that on purpose. This was not me trying to do a major cliffhanger like on the next episode of Delve. No, I wasn't trying to do that. What actually happened was our call got dropped at that moment. And then I spent another 10 minutes or so just panicking. And we did end up reestablishing communication, and we talked to Rudy for quite some time after that, but we were on a different subject by that point, so I figured that this is a good breaking spot between episode one and episode two, because we actually have a lot more to go into. On the next episode, we actually talk about Maze Arcana, about Inkwell Society, which is the new show that is on their Twitch channel. You should check that out. And also about Xanathar's lost notes to everything else, because he was the lead designer for that, and is part of the Guild Adepts, which I was not familiar with either. So a lot of specific project information that we talk about on that episode. We were really happy to have Rudy on the show. We were actually really surprised and excited to have him on the show, but it really just speaks volumes to how he and the rest of the Maze Arcana crew really like to be involved with the community and get out there and talk to people. I think it speaks a lot to that organization, and I really respect that. If you want to find out more about Maze Arcana, it's really easy to find them online. Just www.mazearcana.com. And on Twitch, where they actually do live streams, not just Inkwell Society, but they have other shows as well. It is www.twitch.tv/MazeArcana. And if you want to follow them on Twitter, at Maze Arcana, it's really easy to find them. Don't worry. You can do it. I know you can. You can also follow Rudy on basically any social media platform at Rudy Woot, RUTYWOOT. If you want to find more information about Delve, go over to DelveCast.com. We have all of the stuff we do over there. It's a good landing spot. If you're wondering what we're doing in addition to Delve, all of it's there. You can also find us on iTunes and Google Play and all those good podcast spots, the hubs of activity where podcasts hang out and have a good time. Please rate and review and subscribe when you go. Make sure to check us out on Twitter as well. I am at Citanium, Alex is at EXP Limited, and the show is at Delve Podcast. With that, we are very excited to bring you part two next week, where we will be able to go more into what Inkwell Society is. We get to discuss more about Eberron as a setting, because both Alex and I are fairly unfamiliar with it, and also live streaming in general. So a really good conversation there. You're going to want to tune in next week for that. Until then, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye. Ah! Oh, no!
Look what you did.
I didn't do nothing. I swear I didn't do anything. Oh, no. He'll probably be back in a second.
I assume.
I'm going to make an assumption.
You just... What happened?
I don't know.
Hello?